All right, welcome back. Our next speaker is Gilles Barthes. Gilles is the scientific director at Max Planck Institute for Security and Privacy in Bochum, Germany. He's also a research professor at IMDEA Software Institute in Spain. Gilles has made many contributions to formal verification, computer security, and the theory of programming languages, including the theory of probabilistic programming languages. Among other things, he's made contributions to the design, the definition of program logic for probabilistic programming, but also a fundamental result, such as the equivalence between coupling proofs and probabilistic product programs. He also organized a seminar, a Dextool seminar, and he is one of the editors of the book Foundations of Probabilistic Programming. Today he's going to talk about relational proofs of probabilistic programs and applications to cryptography. And, well, Gilles, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for the introduction, and thanks very much for the invitation to be here. It feels very special to talk to people face to face again, so it's very nice. So today I'm actually going to give a high level overview of some work which we've been doing with a bunch of people, many of them at INRIA in France. So it started when I was employed there, and it's really about trying to apply program verification of probabilistic programs to security problems. And so maybe I should stress before I start, I will be talking here about probabilistic, okay. Also maybe it's me that, I will talk about probabilistic programs, okay. I will be talking about probabilistic programs and not probabilistic programming, which means that, you know, I will have sampling operators but not conditioning operators. And there's a technical reason for this. This is like conditioning is hard for us, and I'll talk for this at the end of the talk, but most importantly, like for the kind of applications we have in mind, conditioning plays no role. So main applications have been so far cryptography, and we're very happy just with sampling operator. And relational verification is a non-conventional kind of verification which goes beyond traditional trace property. And one of the main reasons why we care about relational verification is like many security properties, which is our starting points, are not stated as trace property, but as properties over two program execution. So at a very high level, when you think about relational verification, you just have two programs which take input and outputs, and you want to relate the outputs of the two programs, assuming there is a relationship between the input. So if you're familiar with program verification, you have a notion of precondition and postcondition, and you want to show that if you have some input that satisfies the precondition, you get the output that satisfies the postcondition, modulo some termination condition I'm not going to mention here. So what happens in the setting of relational program verification is that you actually have a relationship on the input states and the relationship on output states. Okay, and other than this, it's kind of standard understanding, and there are many properties that are expressed as relational property. The basic properties, the notion of equivalence, which says that if the inputs are equal, then the outputs are equal. So there's a little bit of mismatch of annotation here. My inputs in the picture are denoted by x1 and x2, and the output by y1 and y2, and in the table I use m1 and m2 as the inputs, and m'1 and m'2 as the output, but otherwise there's the matching. So equivalence is very interesting, for example, when you want to prove that, you know, some compiler optimization preserves the meanings of program, but when you care about security, there is a slightly different notion of equivalence called information flow, where you just divide your inputs between public part and private part, and same for the output, and you want that, you know, the public output does not depend on the secret input. This is something called non-interference, and this is a notion of information flow. and it has been widely studied in language-based security. There's a variant of this which is also very important, which is called leakage resistance, where you don't look at the output of the program, but what they leak. One of the main way to attack program is via side channel. So what you want here is like program leakage does not depend on inputs, which leakage is modeled here as this variable L. Again, there are kind of more classic notion, one being monotonicity, which means, you know, like your program computes a monotonic function, or robustness, which says essentially if you start with inputs which are close, the outputs are close. And robustness has many applications, I guess, in things like cyber-physical system, but it turns out also in things like machine learning. And these properties are stated here for deterministic program, or there's nothing here that says that my programs are probabilistic, but all these notions extend to the probabilistic setting, which is what we will try to study in our work. When you extend to probabilistic setting, you in general have like several variant of the notion, one being again saying, well, like, okay, the function is, for example, in the case of information flow, takes this one for example, you can say, oh, the two output distribution are equal or equal on the low memory, but there are also quantitative versions of this, or where you actually allow for the two distributions not to be equal but to be within a certain statistical distance. So one of the challenge with kind of lifting things to a probabilistic setting will be that we get a little bit of quantitative reasoning. Anyway, so short story, we're interested in reason about relational property of probabilistic program. And the question is, how are we going to do this? Well, we've been kind of looking in the dark for many years, but some years ago, we actually, one of our collaborators, Justin Xu, pointed out that what we had been doing for many years is actually a well-known notion called probabilistic coupling. And so the idea of probabilistic coupling, which was developed, by the way, to reason about property of stochastic processes. So the idea of probabilistic coupling is like you try to analyze two probabilistic processes, and the way you are going to establish a relation between them is kind of build a probabilistic process over the product space, such that when you take its first and second marginal, you get the first process and the second process respectively. And this is actually a very nice and a very powerful tool, which is studied in depth in mathematics and used in depth. Actually, we make a slightly shallow use of couplings, as I will explain shortly, non-conventional. But before I start going into how or what kind of couplings we use, I just want to mention that there is a dimension of choice in how you build couplings. So if you just take, you know, a probabilistic process that just flip a coin, there are actually, in a fair way, there are actually many ways to couple these coin flips. And what I actually show on this slide is a kind of three possible couplings. So now I'm going to build a distribution over, you know, pairs of 0, 1, and there is the trivial coupling, which is the uniform distribution over this space. There is the equality coupling, where you just force the two coin flips to be the same. And there is the inequality coupling, where you actually assign a non-zero or a half distribution only to points which have different left and right coordinate. So there is not one single coupling per two stochastic process. There is a lot of them. And so the question is like, you know, how you build them or which one you want to choose. So actually, which one you want to choose is something which is very important when you reason about stochastic process in the classical setting. So one particular application of probabilistic coupling is to bound the statistical distance between two probabilistic processes. So you have two distribution, mu1 and mu2, and you want to upper bound their statistical distance. And one way to do this is actually to provide a coupling, and then once you have a coupling, you just measure the probability of the event x1 is different from x2, where x1 and x2 are the first and second component of my pairs. Okay, and so you have this lemma which says that whichever coupling you pick, the statistical distance between mu1 and mu2 is upper bounded by the probability of this event. And moreover, there is something called the optimal coupling, which actually realizes this equality. Okay, so makes the inequality some equality. And so here, you know, when you pick a coupling, this will actually give you an upper bound for the distance. So that means like the choice of the coupling matters. Actually, in what we're going to do, it's a bit different. We just have to show that the coupling exists. And this is just because we care about a different kind of couplings. We care about something which is called R coupling. And if you think about it in terms of formal verification, the R coupling is a notion of coupling with some kind of postcondition. So essentially, you try to build a, or find a coupling such that its support lies within a given relationship. Okay, so R coupling for two distribution mu1 and mu2 is just a distribution mu, which is a coupling. So that means it's a distribution over the product space such that the left and the right marginal correspond to the first and second distribution. And moreover, the support of the distribution is included in the relationship. By the way, I'm saying everything here in the setting of discrete distribution, again, because, you know, most of the time when you do cryptography, you care about discrete things, so we don't have to go continuous. And so if we go back to our example of coupling for fair coins, you know, like the trivial coupling doesn't ensure any property because, you know, every element in the space has a non-zero probability, so it just ensures true. The equality coupling ensures equality as a relation, and the inequality coupling ensures that the postcondition that x1 is different from x2. Okay, so different choices of coupling gives you different postconditions. Okay, so all couplings are interesting because they allow you to establish inequality between probability of events. So essentially, if you want to show that the probability of some event E1 is smaller than the probability of some event E2 in distribution mu1 and mu2 respectively, it suffices that you exhibit a coupling, a R coupling for a good choice of the relation R. And so this is actually a very useful lemma which you can instantiate in different way. There is a lemma which allows you to prove the equality of events, and there is a lemma which allows you to upper bound the difference of probability of events by the probability of a third event, and this is called failure event. And it turns out that these two kind of lemmas are extremely powerful to formalize cryptographic proofs. So before I go about applying these couplings for cryptography, I just want to go back to the question of showing existence of R coupling, okay? Because we want to use this as a tool, so it should be possible to exhibit such a coupling. And there is a beautiful theorem by Strassens which gives a sufficient condition for the existence of R coupling, and it's beautiful in the sense that it's, you know, existence of a coupling is obviously an existential statement, and the condition is universally quantifying over all subsets of the space and verifying some inequality between two probabilities. And that's kind of a very nice lemma, and it's also related to some stuff on optimal transport, but from our point of view, you know, we don't want to actually apply this theorem all the time to prove existence of R coupling, and there is a precise technical reason for this, is that we will be reasoning about a probabilistic program on which we don't really have the code, so you can't really compute these probabilities because you don't really have the program. So instead, we're going to use a constructive way to build couplings. And what is nice is like this probabilistic couplings enjoy some composition property. Essentially, at a very high level, what this slide is saying is like when you take the sequential composition of couplings, this is the coupling of the sequential, sorry, the if you look at sequential composition and you want to build a coupling for sequential composition, essentially what you can do is you just build a coupling for each of the component and then you compose the coupling. So this is written here in some kind of monadic style. So D of A is the type of distribution over A, and this lemma is essentially telling you you can compose things in the way you like, and there are like similar closure property for couplings. For example, they are closed under convex combination, which means that when you do some choice or you have an if then else, you can actually also build a coupling for an if then else from the coupling of each of the components. So you have some kind of compositional way to build things, and by some trick of magic, which I will kind of allude to later, we're also able to build coupling for programs on which we don't have the code. You know, essentially using the fact that even if you don't have the code, these programs are computing function from memory to distribution of a memory. So if they start from equal input, they get equal output. And this is enough to reason about open programs. And so one application, or the main application we've been working on since 2005 or 2006, is reductionist proof. So, a modern cryptography is based on the idea that you have to prove the security of each cryptographic construction. And the way it is done is essentially you have they are called probabilistic experiment. And the probabilistic experiment is essentially you have a system interacting against some external party. So external party, you can think about it as a kind of adversary, and you are just going to let this to interact, and you want to measure the probability of an event at the end of the interaction. And the way you do a proof in cryptography, most of the time is a proof by reduction, because everything in cryptography relies on hardness assumption. So the way you're going to do a proof is you're going to say, oh, look, my cryptographic system is secure, where security is defined by this probabilistic experiment. If breaking this experiment implies that I can also break a very hard assumption. And because you assume that the hard assumption cannot be broken, you are kind of have some guarantee that the underlying system is secure. So a typical statement of reductionist security is really like, I'm going to look at any adversary against the scheme, okay? And from this, I'm going to construct. So this is most of the time a constructive proof. So the adversary B is going to use the adversary A as a subroutine, and we're going to give a program for B. So there exists an adversary B against H, which is my hardness assumption, such that the advantage of the adversary A is upper bounded by a function of the advantage of the adversary B. Okay, so the advantage is really the probability that the adversary wins the experiment. And, I put some alpha, delta, and so ideally you want that this alpha is close to 1 and the delta is close to 0, because you want your kind of reduction to be tight. And one thing which is also very important is like, this adversary, they have this hardness problem. Of course, if you have infinite computing power, you will solve them. So a typical hardness problem says, oh, it's hard to solve this in polynomial time. So you also have to think about the execution time. And what you want is like when you do your reduction, you don't change too much the execution time, because otherwise, your security guarantees are very weak. Okay, so our goal is to try to verify this kind of construction using coupling proofs. And the way we are going to do this, we're going to focus on a specific kind of reductionist proof, which I'll call game-based cryptographic proof. So crypto proofs are tricky and error-prone, and cryptographers kind of can easily get lost. So they have developed, you know, proof techniques which kind of increases the reliability or the robustness of their proof, and this is the technique of game-based or game-hopping. And essentially what they do, instead of doing this reduction in one step, they decompose the reduction in multiple steps, and the idea is like each step in isolation deals with one particular aspect of the problem, and it's easier to understand and it's easier to justify. And you know, you have then some kind of steps where you do reduction, but you also have many other kind of steps where you prove program equivalence or conditional program equivalence. And this is actually what we are going to formalize. And what happens, quite luckily, is like many of the proof techniques that cryptographers are using, in particular these bridging steps, this lossing step, and so on, they can actually be formalized using coupling. And many other techniques that they use, hybrid argument and so on, they can be formalized using coupling. So in a way, there is a way to map reasoning done by cryptographer to coupling. And so this is good news, because couplings have a great advantage from the point of view of formal verification, is that you don't really see the probability. You only see probability when you build couplings. So, you know, if you try to do program verification directly on probabilistic program and you use standard techniques like pre-expectation and so on, reasoning is a little bit complicated, but when you use coupling, you get something that has the same feeling as doing program verification. Your assertions are just formulae over memory and so on, and you can use SMT solver, and that makes life much easier. And so what we did is build a tool called EasyCrypt, which is some kind of domain-specific proof assistant, which is specialized for verification of heuristic program. And you know, as a program verification tool, it's kind of a bit non-standard, because you know, many people believe that program verification is extremely good at verifying a simple property of a large program. What we do here is we verify hard property about very small program. So we have a different way of doing things where, you know, proofs are done interactively over the structure of program, and we use still automation from SMT solvers to discharge many of the goals. And we've used this tool for many case studies, so in particular, you know, for statistical proofs. So this is the first line, you know, like showing constant time, showing masking. Masking is a countermeasure against power analysis, where, you know, people examine the power consumption of program execution to retrieve the secret. And ORAM, which is something else, but here this is like statistical, so there is no cryptographic reduction. So we've done many of these. We've also done many crypto primitive like encryption, signatures, key exchange, zero knowledge. And we did some bigger crypto system like multi-party computation, verifiable computation. We had some project with NIST, which is National Institute of Standard and Technology, to verify SHA-3, which is a standard hash function. KMS was a project we had with AWS to verify their key management system. So we've done a lot. We've done a lot of example with this tool, and we are still doing, of course. So let me tell you a little bit more how it goes. So actually, perhaps amazingly, we have a very simple modeling language, which is a while language with primitives from sampling. For sampling from a distribution, and we also have procedure calls, which is not a big deal, you know. So that's what we have. One thing which is a bit non-standard is our procedure calls. We also allow for abstract procedure to represent the adversary. Okay, and we also have a module system to kind of reason about permission and whatever. I'm not going to talk about this here. And then we have this kind of relational hall logic for our probabilistic program. So essentially, you know, it has a precondition and a postcondition like Hall logic, except that the precondition and the postcondition are relation on memory. And then our two programs, our C1 and C2, they are probabilistic program taking from the programming language shown on the previous slide. And then essentially a judgment is valid if and only if if you start from two memory that satisfy the precondition, you can construct a coupling for the postcondition on the output distribution. Okay, so essentially, this judgment asserts the existence of a coupling. And we have proof rules for this logic. I'm not going to go very much into the detail of this proof rule. Just what I just want to show here is, like, if you're familiar with Hall logic, this will look very familiar. There is not so much difference with classic program verification. This is why I say it retains the feeling of program verification. So one thing which is a bit different, of course, is like we have to handle this random assignment. And essentially, when we have a random assignment, yes, at this point, you have to exhibit a coupling, you know, the coupling you want to use to tie the two programs together. And you can choose the coupling, and then you get a proof obligation to show that the coupling that you establish actually validates the post condition you're after. And there is a class of coupling which is called bijective couplings, which we use quite often in the tool, where, you know, what you have to prove in terms of probability is fairly limited. So that's kind of a fairly simple logic, but it's fairly effective. The only thing that we have to add on top of this is the rule for adversary. And you know, the rule for adversary goes back to what I said earlier on, and you don't know what an adversary is doing. So, but you know that this is kind of purely probabilistic. So when you try to model, you know, crypto proof, the adversary is purely probabilistic. There is no non-determinism. So you know that you can see your adversary as a function from state to distribution of a state. So it's a little bit more complicated here because, you know, adversary have access to oracles, so it makes the rule a little bit more complicated. But essentially what the rule for adversary is saying is, like, if you give an adversary equal input, it will produce equal output because it is just a function. Okay? And so that's the logic. And quite nicely, actually, we recently proved that this logic, and in particular this rule, is sound for quantum adversary. So you can even assume that your adversary is kind of a quantum process. Of course, you know, it interacts with a classical system here because X1 and E1 are meant to be a classic expression, but you can suppose that your adversary is quantum, which is quite useful for the future. So on top of this, we have a few logic that I will not go into detail, but, you know, are important. So we have a logic to give upper bound to the probability of events, because, you know, when you just say two processes or two programs are equivalent up to some event, you have to bound the probability of event. And so what we are trying to use now is a very old logic due to Cousin, Dexter Cousin. It was invented in 85, and it's actually working pretty well. I don't know why we didn't choose this from the start, but okay, we're shifting to this. A special case for this is that we have to prove almost short termination, you know, because probabilistic program might have a probability of non-terminating, and many of our rules require that programs are almost fully terminating, means they terminate with probability one. And as I mentioned in my assignment of reductionist proof, we have to talk about the execution time. And so we do cost analysis of probabilistic program. It's very different from what other people are doing. You know, people who do program verification, they care about expected cost. In cryptography, you talk about worst case cost. And there is some kind of strange features like oracle counters and open program that make it quite interesting, but I will not talk about this here. So our main project at the moment, or the main application of this framework, is trying to build a high assurance library for post-quantum cryptography. So there is a lot of attention being paid at the moment to transition to post-quantum crypto. And this effort is being structured by a competition by NIST. So NIST is actually starting, I think it's called a competition. I never know whether it's called a competition or a process or whatever, but the outcome is the same. So they are kind of selecting future standards for post-quantum crypto. And it started in 2016, and we are now at the third round, and they have chosen finalists. You know, there are maybe seven finalists. I think I put one or two more on the slide because there are also some alternates that might be reconsidered. But essentially, there is seven or eight finalists, and they were supposed to announce the winner by March 2022. They are a little bit late, you know, but essentially, out of this, they are going to pick the standards which are going to be used in crypto for the next 20 or 30 years. And the idea is that once they pick the finalist, there will be some standardization by 2024. And it turns out that, you know, in the place I'm working in MPI in Bochum, one of our researchers, Peter Schwaber, is actually involved in four or five of these eight. So we have a strong incentive to try to work on developing a verified library for this, and we also have a very good insider's knowledge. So what we are trying to do at the moment is to build a library that actually achieves all desirable property for crypto implementation. So first of all, it has to be super efficient, and this entails a lot of exciting problems in programming languages, you know, because a lot of these people, they don't believe in high-level language, they don't believe in compilers, they write their assembly by hand, they use all crazy optimization. And so that's the first thing. But from the point of view of verification, we want to do provable security, we want to show there's no side channel, and we want to show functional correctness. And for this, we're just going to use EasyCrypt plus some language which we've been developing in parallel, which is called Jasmine, which is meant to help us verify low-level implementation using high-level standard program verification technology. And so currently, you know, the plan is to have a pre-release in fall 2022, so this fall, and what we're going to do is try to prove only secret independent leakage, but it's actually already quite tricky because this program, they have rejection sampling, they sample from some crazy distribution, they use something called the quantum random oracle, which is kind of a very ugly beast. And so even this is a lot of fun. And so we also have done a lot of work on security and correctness proof, you know, but this will not be finalized by summer. So this is kind of the main ongoing application of EasyCrypt, but over the years we've been working on two different applications. One is differential privacy. So differential privacy is kind of a mathematical notion to ensure, you know, privacy of computation that operate over private data, and it has a nice mathematical definition. And we've been extending our framework to reason about differential privacy. You just need to use a different notion of coupling. And we've been doing many examples for this. It's actually, we're running a bit late behind the train at the moment, you know, because people who are interested in differential privacy, for example, of stochastic gradient descent, they are kind of developing crazy mathematical analysis. Some of them, they use like stochastic differential equation and whatever to try to get better privacy bounds. I mean, this is not something we'll ever be able to verify with our techniques, you know. Our techniques are mostly based on budget counting. So every time you call, you know, some primitive like Laplacian or whatever, you pay. So kind of there is an additive budget. And now people have proved that the budget, you know, is upper bounded. So our technique is kind of, I don't know what we'll do with it. We're also trying to do stuff on machine learning. So there is this nice property called algorithmic stability. For many years, you know, I wanted to do proof about algorithmic stability. I believe I talked to Andy in Cambridge in 2012, like, oh, what can we do? And whatever, we didn't know, but now there are people who study algorithmic stability. We did proof and we managed to verify this proof, so that's actually quite fun. You know, I think we do very simple stuff, but it's still a lot of fun for me. And there's a lot of open questions. So as I said in the beginning of my talk, we do probabilistic programs and not probabilistic programming. And this is all fine for crypto. This is a bit less fine if you want to do more stuff on machine learning. And there is one thing which I never understood is, can we use coupling to say something about program with conditioning? And maybe people have the answer, some answer, but I don't understand the problem, and I tried a long time. There is this other interesting challenge. Now, you know, we do post-quantum crypto, and so the next step, you know, if you want to show or go broader, is try to reason about quantum program, but this is a whole very complicated world, and what does coupling means for quantum program and whatever. There are some proposals, you know, but nothing very definitive. And also, if you do program logic, you know, there is this question of completeness, which is super exciting, and we have not really answered. So I think I'm done, and I'm happy to take questions. So thanks for your attention.